In the last 2 years, they have lost Gaza. They have lost Syria. They've lost Lebanon. They've now lost Venezuela. They've been humiliated and exposed as utterly vulnerable by Israel, by the United States. They are a shell of what they were on October 6th, 2023. A shell. And everybody in Iran knows it. Everybody in the world knows it. So they're not coming back that way. Iran has no ability to defend itself against our counterattack. It would be a suicidal move. Instead of being a recipient of handouts for the United States, we should be in a partnership with the United States. We have to prepare for possible change. Whether the next president is J.D. Vance or some Democrat, we have to prove again and again that we are a worthwhile ally to the United States. It's precisely, we have to do what the Europeans are not doing. This war is more transformative than the 67 war. If it ends truly with peace with our neighbors, we could have peace with Saudi Arabia, peace with the Sunni Arab world. Our biggest challenge in the coming years, especially for you of your generation, will be how to deal with all this peace.
Hey, Lab, it's great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. What's up with you?
Well, I'm preparing for tonight. I just got a very poetic message from, I think, the IRGC in Iran. Though it might also be from the British government. I'm not sure, because it's from a British number. And the message is, the midnight sky will shine, the comets that are not stars, meteors that are not meteors, and suddenly terrifying sounds. Now, we know, obviously, that the Persian culture, poetry, you know, is plays a major role. So I have to say, I give credit to the Iranian regime for investing in the lyrical nature of the random fest they're sending to Israelis. Though I should say that this was, I think, a text message sent probably to everybody who was in Naftali Bennett's phone when his numbers got leaked.
I also was in his phone, and I've gotten a couple messages, but I didn't get that one. I got one on Saturday, which says, "We are coming. Look at the sky in the midnight." I have to admit to whoever sent this to me that I was asleep in the midnight, but from what I understand, nothing happened.
I have to say, though, the phishing attempts are becoming more and more sophisticated. I believe that they're Iranian. I got one that was supposedly from an Israeli diplomat asking to set up a time to speak to me about the Abraham Accords, which, you know, is a not unreasonable thing. The only thing is I didn't recognize the phone number because it was an American phone number, not his Israeli phone number. And when I checked it, it did not come from him. And apparently similar messages were sent to a few different people.
So I also, before the news, I don't know when Bennett's phone was actually hacked, but before the news of it being hacked came out, like weeks before, I got a Twitter direct message from Tali Ploskov, who's a former Knesset member, first in the Kulanu party and then in Likud, like a backbencher. So if people haven't heard of her, don't feel too bad. But she messaged me out of the blue and wanted also to meet to discuss something. And I thought that was weird because, you know, I am no longer a Knesset reporter. So I went and I checked her phone number. Like, I wanted to make sure she hadn't changed because she asked for my number and if I gave it to her. And then after that, I started to suspect. So then I went and I checked with current Knesset reporters what her phone number was, and I realized it was wrong. So I went to the real Tali Ploskov and I told her that this was happening, and she said, "It's not just me."
I think the Iranians, they've apparently had some success with Bennett's phone, with Ayala Shaked's phone, Benny Gantz's phone before that. They're definitely upping, and of course we hear again and again, I think there are 35 different cases where people have been, Israelis have been arrested for spying for Iran or for carrying out missions for Iran. They're obviously increasing their attempts. And personally, I have to become much more careful about what messages and anything that's sent to me, to be really, really very careful about what people are sent.
Yeah, years ago, people were impersonating me and also someone else who was at the Jerusalem Post at the time, Liat Collins, to try to talk to, it was mostly academics who were researching and writing about Iran. But I these people would reach out to me and say, like, "Is this really you?" And I'd be like, "Nope, it's Iran."
From the latest reports, what do you think we're seeing? And what's your sense of where we're heading with regards to the turmoil and the courageous demonstrations in Iran?
Like, we're seeing increased violence from the regime, but it doesn't seem to be stopping the protests. People seem to be very determined. The thing that I keep bringing up when people talk to me about this is that the 1979 revolution took 11 months. Mm-hmm. So I do think I mean, things work a lot faster now with internet and everything. And also President Trump, just in general, being a non-traditional president, let's put it that way. So I don't know that if it happens, it'll take 11 months again. But I think like people who are looking at it are like, something's going to happen now. I think need to have some patience.
The question is how long, at least in the current wave, can the protesters hold out? But because neither the Ayatollah leadership nor the country's presidents have any actual solution to the economic problems, the core factor driving the revolution is not going to go anywhere. The impact that this would have on the entire region, on the entire Middle East, is incredibly far-reaching. I was watching the press gaggle that of President Trump on Air Force One, I think from yesterday, I believe, where he was asked, and he talked about we're preparing for very strong options, and he's no longer talking about just people dying from a stampede, but you know, talking about how the Iranian regime is killing protesters. And I think that it really does come down, in a certain case, at least in terms of American U.S. action, to the degree to which President Trump sees that as serving his American first worldview and his American interests in the region and more broadly.
It's an interesting question. I mean, we know that the Iranian regime threatens the U.S., even though they were revealed to be somewhat of a paper tiger back in June. They still have, you know, ICBMs. Their nuclear program seems to be doing quite badly since then, but, you know, they still have some remains of it that they have yet to agree to give up. They sponsor terrorism all around the world, including attacks on Americans. Trump, when it comes to Venezuela, seems to be talking a lot about the oil industry. Well, you know, there's sanctions on their oil industry, but then they're selling oil to China anyway. They sell weapons, the drones mostly, to Russia. So these are all reasons why Iran is, you know, a threat and a problem for America. I mean, in addition to them threatening Israel, who's an American ally, I think, you know, the like Tucker Carlson's and Dave Smith's of the world aren't going to be convinced by that. But I do think that that is a strong argument to make.
It's interesting. A lot of people have been asking themselves, what are the guiding principles underlying Trump's foreign policy or his military, his national security approach? Somebody said to me this morning that Trump is acting like a neocon. I don't know if I would agree with that. But it's interesting, you know, when President Bush, who was, you know, acted in Iraq, certainly partly for his desire to bring democracy, out of the belief that it was possible to bring democracy to Iraq, but he was accused of doing it for American energy interests. Well, that ended up being a very long, protracted, expensive, and bloody war. President Trump and his action in Venezuela, which overtly was clearly, at least partly, about American energy interests, well, that led to a much more precise and limited attack which, you know, in the end, will help secure those American energy interests. It's very interesting. I was looking at Biden's 2022 national security strategy vis-a-vis Trump's 2025 national security strategy. And the difference obviously couldn't be more stark. Biden talks about how this is the window of opportunity to deal with shared threats like climate change will narrow drastically, that no nation is better positioned than the United States as long as we work in common cause with those who share our vision of the world that is free and open, right? It's very much based on this idea of the United States needs to work in tandem with other global powers, with the international order. And if you look at the first lines of, or the first, you know, substantive section of President Trump's national security strategy, we want to protect this country, its people, and its territory. We want full control over our borders and our immigration. We want a resilient national infrastructure. We want to recruit, train, equip, and field the world's most powerful, lethal, and advanced military to protect our interests. We want the world's most robust, credible, and modern nuclear deterrent. And it goes on and on. It's very much America first, in the sense of American national power and America acting to preserve what it sees as its interests, whether that's in Iran or Venezuela or Greenland, without too much philosophy, ideology, what Trump calls common sense corollary to the Monroe Doctrine.
So you don't think it's why Tucker Carlson said that America took down Maduro because of globo homo?
Oh, right, because of gay marriage, which is obviously what I think we're aiming for in Iran as well.
Right, or just in general that Trump is aiming for. I think Trump is neutral on that topic, let's say.
But I think what you were talking about before, the case of to what degree would action in Iran serve American interests, and all the interests that I think you pointed out beforehand are you know, very, very valid and very, very important, that's going to be the key question going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that Trump, you know, people are talking about Trump, the neocon, like you said, that he reaches a lot of the same conclusions as the quote-unquote neocons, which I people should go back and watch our episode where we interviewed David Wormser, and he talks about that term and what it means and what it doesn't mean. But, you know, whatever, colloquially, what people like to call the neocons when they're not just saying, when they don't just mean Jews. he reaches the same conclusion in a very different way, mm-hmm. and he speaks a very different language. So, you know, you have Elliot Abrams, let's say, who at this point is, you know, maybe the only real classic neocon who hasn't fallen out with Trump, right? He was glad that Trump took down Maduro, but within a day he had ran an op-ed for the Free Press where he said, well, you know, taking down Maduro is not enough. You have to have a real plan to have actual regime change, right? If you want to bring democracy to Venezuela, like, it's not enough to replace Maduro with Delcy Rodriguez with his vice president. So there are definitely differences there. And Trump, of course, talking so much about the oil in Venezuela. And I'm sure that if he takes action in Iran, he'll talk about the oil there too, because Trump looks at things in a much more transactional and business-based way, right? Whereas the quote-unquote neocon agenda has more to do with bringing democracy to people.
The other headline with Iran and Venezuela didn't certainly get much international attention is that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, was taken to the hospital in Ramallah today. It was reported that it was for routine tests, but Abbas is 90 years old, I think in the 20 or 21st year of his 4-year term.
He's a 90-year-old chain smoker too. I don't know if you've had the...
Maybe that's what's keeping him healthy. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you've had the privilege that I've had of being in the Mukata, but it's like you can't breathe. The smoke is so thick in there. I mean, frankly, it's what Israel used to be like 25, 30 years ago, but it's not anymore. And so when you go there, you're like, oh my God, it's been like maybe 5 years since I've been there, but I doubt it's changed.
And the question is, you know, what happens if he steps down, he's no longer chair tomorrow? I think formally there's a Hussein al-Sheikh, his deputy, is supposed to take over. We have to remember, we have to recall that according to the best available polling that we have, the Palestinian Surveys and Policy Research, the 59% of the population in the West Bank, in the PA, believes that Hamas's October 7th attack was the correct move. In a theoretical election between Hamas leader Khaled Mashal and Abbas, I believe, if I recall correctly, Mashal would get 63% of the vote and Abbas would get nearly 25% of the vote. I think 16%, 23% of the population is happy with the PA, 16% is happy with Abbas, and that's a relatively high number compared to previous polling. Bottom line is, obviously, the most popular figure is Marwan Barghouti, the convicted terrorist murderer.
He's very popular in the entertainment industry, too.
Awesome.
I don't know if you saw, like, a few weeks ago, there was this big petition with hundreds of people, some of them like pretty big names in Hollywood and in music, calling to free Marwan Barghouti because, you know, he's the one who's going to bring peace. And then Bono of U2, you know, the man who claims to have saved Africa from starvation, he also wrote a whole op-ed about how, you know, I don't remember his exact wording, but it was very similar to that Israeli cliche of you make peace with your enemies. And therefore, Barghouti must be freed. And I was like, Bono was doing so well after October 7th, recognizing, you know, that Israel had been attacked and had a right to defend itself, etc. But now he's just back in the old cliches. Barghouti is, of course, serving multiple life sentences for terrorism.
For murdering not just Israeli Jews, but Israeli Druze, Christians. I mean, he's a... That's his claim to fame, essentially. It's his responsibility for the murder and for numerous prominent terrorist attacks.
Right, and it's like, what does that tell you about Palestinian society, that's who they view as their leader?
I think the most likely scenario is, I don't believe that Israel's going to release Marwan Barghouti, I would certainly hope not, is that whenever Abbas steps off the world stage, you had this diffusion of power between the PA and Fatah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and local terror groups and various local clans and power brokers and powerful families. And you still have the Palestinian Authority functioning in name and perhaps, you know, in charge of Ramallah and maybe some of the other environments, but you have other power brokers and other factions and gangs and armed groups de facto controlling other parts of the PA from the north of the West Bank to the south. And that obviously might also impact what happens. It may or may not impact what happens in Gaza with the Board of Peace, with this Palestinian Technocratic Committee. But in all the things that we're talking about that we have to keep an eye on, that's something else that we should be keeping an eye on in terms of how it impacts the region.
Before we move to our guest, I want to just say a few words about Gabi Barkai, who is an archaeologist who passed away this week. He was born in the Budapest ghetto in Hungary and immigrated to Israel as a child, and he's had a huge impact on the world of biblical archaeology. That was his specialty. And he was one of the people who started the Temple Mount Sifting Project, which is also extremely important. The Waqf, which is the Islamic trust that runs the Temple Mount because the Al-Aqsa Mosque is there, they had illegal construction and underground sort of excavation under the Temple Mount. And there were tons, like literal tons, hundreds of trucks of earth removed from the Temple Mount. And Barkai and Elam Mazar, another archaeologist, saved that dirt. And for the past 20 years, I think the project only just ended last year, people had been sifting through that dirt and they found all kinds of proof of the Jewish presence on the Temple Mount through the ages. So I really just thought we should pay tribute to this really giant of archaeology and important figure now for Israeli history and historiography and just, you know, our history and our rights in the land of Israel.
Absolutely. That's an incredible legacy. It was an incredible project. And the work that he did to help strengthen the archaeological proof and the indications of the ancient and timeless Jewish connection to Jerusalem, to the Temple Mount, to the land, is incredibly important. So thank you for bringing that up.
So our guest this week is a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, and we're going to discuss the latest news about U.S. military aid to Israel. Is that going by the wayside or not? But before that, just want to mention, this is the Misagav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, where the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misagav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misagav Institute and a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misagav Institute, for those who aren't familiar, is Israel's leading national security policy center. We're dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances and standing. And every week here on the Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise to bring you fresh insights into the most important events and developments on the Middle East and Israeli national security agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
This week's guest is Michael Oren. Michael Oren has had a long and distinguished career as a historian, a diplomat, a politician, and an advocate for the State of Israel. From 2009 to 2013, he served as Israel's ambassador to the United States. From 2015 to 2019, he served as a member of Knesset and deputy minister in charge of public diplomacy. He has written three best-selling works of nonfiction, including 6 Days of War on the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, Power, Faith, and Fantasy on the U.S.-Israel Relationship from a Historical Perspective, and Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. He also published in 2023 the work 2048, The Rejuvenated State, about the future of the State of Israel. He has served as a visiting professor at Harvard, Yale, Georgetown, and other universities, and he's the founder of the Israel Advocacy Group. He's been named by Politico as one of the top 50 thinkers in the United States and by the Jerusalem Post as one of the 10 most influential Jews worldwide. We go in depth into the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship, Iran, Gaza, what's happening on American universities. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Michael Oren. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former member of Knesset and deputy minister for public diplomacy, and one of Israel's most gifted historians, particularly in the field of diplomacy and the military. It's a pleasure to have you on Mideast Horizons.
Great to be with you, Asher. Great to be with you, Lahav.
You know, I thought of reaching out to you this week after I heard, and it's always a good time to talk to you, but after I heard Prime Minister Netanyahu say that he wants to ramp down, I think was the word he used, U.S. military aid to zero in the next decade. And you've been talking about this for years now, long before it was popular. I would say during the current war, it became a more popular thing to say. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about why you've been saying this for so long?
Well, it is ironic that I'm, you know, Mr. Israel America, right? Why would I, using a classical Shakespearean term, why would I dafka be the person to be calling for the end of U.S. military aid? And I have for a long time. And in 2016, when I was in the Israeli government, I was the only member of the government to oppose the Obama MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding. That was the 10-year, $40 billion package. I opposed it and had some very interesting conversations with the Prime Minister about it. He understood what I was saying, but he also had some very compelling reasons for approving the MOU or seeking it. And then in 2021, I came out with an article in Tablet magazine that set out my arguments against the continuation of American aid. It was very unpopular at the time, needless to say, not with, you know, some of our friends in the United States, particularly with AIPAC, but I stood by it. And I think today, you know, if one wants to see vindicated, if vindication means anything, I think pretty much everyone is on the same page. And what does the page say? That American military aid to the state of Israel, which is today an affluent, strong, independent country, is not consonant with our sovereignty. We are the only country in the world, you know, apart from Ukraine now, which has annual military aid. There are other countries that actually get more military support, like Germany and Japan and South Korea, but it's not designated as aid. It's earmarked as part of the Pentagon budget. Actually, they get considerably more than we do. But we are designated as aid. It's like aid to a poor country in Africa. It'd be the same thing, same type of aid. And in that aid, we are told what we can buy. We are told what we can sell. So there's a tremendous matter of opportunity costs. We can't really market things that even have American components in them, military equipment. And it exposes us to blackmail, to put it in the coarsest terms. But people will say, and you've heard it again and again during this war, we give you aid, therefore we can tell you what to do. If Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, can get up and say, call for elections in the state of Israel, well, he can do that because he's paid you, okay? Which means that we're less than sovereign. And by the way, Chuck Schumer's probably right. We are less than sovereign. And that is not, as I said, that is not consonant with an independent sovereign state, and certainly an independent Jewish state. Now, we were getting now, under the current MOU, about $4 billion a year in aid. And as you know, that aid is a subsidy for the American arms market. Basically, the United States is paying arms manufacturers in the United States, the makers of the F-35, for example, Lockheed Martin, out of wonderful Texas, to make these airplanes. And the United States basically paid them to give us those airplanes. And it's a great deal for the United States. Look how many countries in the world want the F-35 now that it has proven just an extraordinary, extraordinary plane in combat conditions. So it's free advertisement, it's free trials, which you really can't put a price tag on. But what does $4 billion in aid buy you every year? For example, $4 billion is exactly one half the cost of a Zimwat class destroyer. So it gets you half a boat. $4 billion. It's not that much money anymore. Think about $4 billion. And what are you paying for the $4 billion? You have, you know, members of Congress going up squeezing us. And during wartime, cutting off the supply of vital forms of ammunition to the state of Israel.
I can tell you on a personal level, when I was in Lebanon and we had driven Hezbollah out of one village And then the question was, are we going to continue to the next village in order to drive them out of the next village as well, deeper into Lebanon? And one of the reasons why we decided not to was because we didn't have enough. There was a concern that there wouldn't be enough shells because Biden was holding those shells up.
And it even preceded that, because I actually did some building up in the north and then visiting artillery bases. They showed me the number of shells they had to fire every day. And it wasn't a lot. But my position was informed by what happened not in 2023 or 4, but what happened in 2014, when during the operation against Hamas in Gaza, President Obama said that we were killing entirely too many Palestinians. You've heard that before. And he held up the supply of vital helicopter-fired Hellfire rockets to the state of Israel. And I had said to the prime minister now in 2016, 2 years later, what happens if we're in a bigger war? And we have a president who decides that we're killing too many people on the other side. We're going to be dependent on this, and we have to achieve independence. So I think, again, the issue of vindication, now everyone acknowledges that we have to have independence, certainly with abduction of certain types of munitions, specifically 155 millimeter artillery shells, 120 millimeter tank shells. No country is completely independent. Militarily, no country. We should certainly wean ourselves of spare parts from any country that boycotted us during this war, the British, the Canadians, the Spanish, goes without saying. But 99% of our arms come from the United States. And instead of being as a recipient of handouts to the United States, we should be in a partnership with the United States. We should be in a partnership in areas that are of mutual benefit to our security. Whether it's in cyber, laser, intelligence sharing, and get this relationship on a completely different basis. So I was heartened to hear the prime ministers talk about sort of gradually weaning us off of this military over the course of 10 years. I agree with Senator Lindsey Graham that this should be expedited.
In 2011, when you published your seminal essay, Israel, the Ultimate Ally in Foreign Affairs, I was then a junior employee in the Prime Minister's Strategic Communications Directorate, and I got a request to translate it for the Israeli audience, for the Hebrew-speaking audience. This was before chat, obviously, ChatGPT, and I think Google Translate was also still in its early days. And I worked really hard, and I translated it to Hebrew, and I got back a thank you letter from Ambassador Michael Oren, which I think I still have saved today somewhere. So thank you again for that small gesture.
That's small potatoes for a smart Harvard kid.
Yeah. but in that essay, you talked about, you know, the shared interests and the shared democratic values. Now, we were talking just before about the new 2025 U.S. national security strategy, very much focused on America first, on shared interests, on the benefits that are accrued to the United States from cooperation. Beyond sort of the headlines, somebody who's been on the inside, who really seen how that relationship works, what is the America First case or the shared interest case for the U.S.-Israel partnership?
That's a fascinating question. I think that's a very pertinent question for right for now, today, Asher. Yes, it's changed. The situation is dynamic. And clearly there are far-reaching processes afoot in the United States, over which Israel has no input. We didn't invent wokeism. We didn't invent intersectionality. We certainly didn't invent MAGA, but we're certainly also on the receiving end a lot of these movements, and we can't ignore them. And our ability to infect them, as I said, is minimal. But we have to prepare for possible change. Whether the next president is J.D. Vance or some Democrat, we don't know. The relationship as we've known it in previous decades, going back really to the 1970s, it seems to be on the verge of a change. And we have to adapt. You know, we adapted pretty well when, at the end of the Cold War, when the U.S.-Israel relationship was really based on the fact that we were both opposed to Soviet communism and their satellites. We moved right into the war on terror. We were the allies in the war of terror. And we have to prove over and over again that far beyond our shared values, and those shared values seem to be to occupy a far smaller component of American foreign policy thinking today, certainly among MAGA Republicans, we have to prove again and again that we are a worthwhile ally to the United States. We have to do what the Europeans are not doing. The Europeans are not proving, at least not to the people around the White House, not proving that they are an indispensable ally. We have to show that we're the indispensable allies. And I think we're doing not a bad job. More has to be invested, certainly on the public diplomacy side, explaining to the American people why an investment in Israel, and I don't mean aid, I mean an investment, a partnership, an alliance with Israel, is totally in keeping with America First. It is, in fact, the, you know, you can say it's the epitome or the apotheosis of America First. But that's a job that we have to set for ourselves. That's our task.
For our audience, probably your best known book is 6 Days of War, but you also wrote this really great book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, about the U.S. involvement in the Middle East from 1776 until, I'm not sure what year the book was published, mm-hmm. but it was a long history. And with that sort of historic view, I guess, how are you looking at President Trump's remarks about Iran saying that they're going to get involved? You know, we're now at a moment, by the time this podcast comes out, anything could happen.
Right.
But we're now at a moment where President Trump has said a lot about getting involved, but hasn't done so yet.
Well, I've got to sort of criticize myself here. A little moment of self-criticism. I had thought several months ago, certainly before the June war against Iran, that my book was passé, that the thesis of this book, you can see it sitting on the bookshelf behind me, it's only 700 pages and available at famously reduced prices now.
Right, I remember once you saying that you wanted to call it Fantasy, Faith, and Power, but that your publisher said that no men would buy the book if it was called Fantasy, Faith,
and Power. And they're right. It did become a bestseller, a New York Times bestseller, but they wouldn't have bought, it wouldn't become a bestseller if it started off with Fantasy. No, it's my favorite book, actually, true. It's a labor of love, 700 pages. And I stand by it, but I thought that the thesis of it had been disproven or outmoded by events. Why? What's the thesis? The thesis is that American foreign policy in the Middle East could follow three major themes or motifs. One was faith, that Americans were guided by Christian faith, by democratic faith to spread democracy throughout the world. America existed not as a country just for its own citizens, but for the globe. Secondly, fantasy, a lot of fantasies, the notion that there would be a sort of a George Washington of the Middle East who would unite the Middle Eastern countries into United States of the Middle East. And they can see innumerable examples of this throughout American history. And then power that America was willing to project power in the Middle East, whether it be economic power or certainly military power. And what you'll be, if you read this book, you'll be astounded to see the amount of times that America projected power, going back to the first war that the independent United States fought after the revolution, after the Revolutionary War, was a war against the Barbary pirates of the Middle East, against Arabs. And I thought that with the emergence of a seemingly irreversible isolationist trend in American foreign policy, both among Republicans and Democrats. They seem to be vying for a while to see which party could be most isolationist, that the power aspect of this had disappeared. And what you're seeing now, certainly in the last 8-9 months, is the resurgence, the revival of this power component in America's policy toward the Middle East. It's almost as if Donald Trump cannot help himself. And here he is going against tremendous opposition within his own party, within the MAGA movement, that's saying, hey, you betrayed your promises to your voters. You said you were going to focus on America First, on domestic issues, and here you are getting involved in the Ukraine and Venezuela and Nigeria and Israel and Iran. It's almost as if he's operating out of a deep American trope, almost in the DNA of America's foreign policy. Now, what has maybe changed is the faith component. As you mentioned just in your previous question, America doesn't seem to be operating so much out of a place of faith. And yet, you know, several weeks ago, here comes Donald Trump and bombs ISIS targets in Nigeria. Why? To help Christians. To help Christians. Not Americans, by the way. And I published an article. I'm going to give a plug to my Substack. It's called Clarity. And you can subscribe to it. And an article came out just after that attack showing the many times over the course of the last 200 plus years, America has sent its military to defend Christians in the Middle East. This is not the first time this has happened. So here is a president who's kind of reverting to form. And so the book you see on the shelf, you should still read it.
It's very interesting that some people look at President Trump as a break with previous American foreign policy doctrines. But I think it's very interesting you're pointing out that in some ways it's consistent or maybe a restoration of earlier patterns, which I think is really interesting. If we put you on the spot, what is your prediction in terms of what we're going to see in Iran? Is the Ayatollah regime going to remain in power? Will the U.S. act? What are maybe potential outcomes that people aren't considering? It's not a dichotomy. So what do you think comes next?
Let me begin by saying that the regime's days, one way or another, are numbered. In the last 2 years, they have lost Gaza. They have lost Syria. They've lost Lebanon. They've now lost Venezuela. They've been humiliated and exposed as utterly vulnerable by Israel, by the United States. They are a shell of what they were on October 6th, 2023. A shell. And everybody in Iran knows it. Everybody in the world knows it. So they're not coming back that way. I mean, and now that Donald Trump has put a credible military threat on the table, and that preceded the outbreak of protests there. I think that the true marker was when he met with Prime Minister Netanyahu several weeks ago. And I was surprised. I was surprised just how openly he put that credible military threat on the table. I thought he would be more cautious given the kind of resistance he has within his own party and his own movement. It's out there. And that Israel gets a green light from him in Lebanon, maybe now in Gaza, we'll see. So that is extraordinary. So number of things can happen. You can say that the United States is going to get involved militarily there. I'm not quite sure what is that the impact will have on actually the domestic situation in Iran. Play it out, Lahav Asher, play it out. What happens? The United States bombs Iranian military bases. It bombs the headquarters of the IRGC. It's like Israel bombing Erin Prison during the war last summer. How much does that actually affect the internal domestic situation in Iran, or in any way impairs the ability of the regime to oppress or suppress, would be the right word, these demonstrations? At the regime's disposal are an army of almost a half a million soldiers, IRG forces of more than a half a million, and 5 million members of the Basij. This is the paramilitary thugs who will go out with a baseball bat and hit you on your head if you protest. Okay, you're talking about something in the order of 6.5 to 7 million forces at your disposal to deal with, I don't know, tens of thousands. I don't know if it's hundreds of thousands of people in the streets.
Assuming that they all remain loyal to the regime.
Now, that's what we get. So maybe, and I suggested this on a Hero Radio broadcast this morning, that we may see a Venezuela-like scenario where senior elements in the IRGC cut a deal with Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if these discussions are not going on right now as we're talking. We're going to get rid of some of these baddies. We're going to get rid of Khamenei. We're going to get rid of, some of the bad mullahs. That's probably redundant, bad mullah. We're going to cut a deal with you. We're going to cut a deal with you where Iran's going to go back into America's orbit. We're going to give you a tremendous amount of control over our oil industry, which is going to give the United States an immense leverage over China, because China is heavily, heavily dependent on Iranian oil supplies. I don't think Trump is going to demand that they make peace with Israel, but it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be the best outcome from Israel, but it would be far from the worst outcome from Israel. Worst outcome for us when the Iranians start shooting at us. I think that's an unlikely outcome. I really do. Iran has no ability to defend itself against our counterattack. It would be a suicidal move. It's probably the wrong image, but it's a Hail Mary for the Iranian regime, for the Islamic Republic. A Hail Mary for the Islamic Republic. I wouldn't rule that out, folks. I wouldn't rule that out. And that agreement will have a nuclear component as well.
So you mentioned the Netanyahu-Trump meeting. The credible military threat that President Trump mentioned in the press conference seemed to be an Israeli threat, right? It was like a few weeks ago, the topic of conversation was the resurgent Iranian ballistic missile program and whether Israel would strike the missile program or not. And now everybody's gotten very quiet, in fact, to the point that Netanyahu put a moratorium on his government and members of Likud talking about Iran in the media, as of Sunday, at least. So what do you think Israel's calculus is right now? And when I say Israel's calculus, I mean not just about whether this is the right time to attack Iran, but also, the regime likes to say that these protests are sponsored by Israel. Probably not. But is there Israeli involvement, encouragement, providing of resources? What do you think Israel's calculations are in terms of those things?
I think Israel, and I say this very guardedly, okay, has the ability to assist the protesters with communications, with information. I mean, look at the degree and the depth to which we had penetrated Iran prior to June 2025. I mean, we knew where everyone was sleeping. We knew what they ate for breakfast. And so that's tremendous. That's tremendous leverage advantage for the protesters to know these things. Are we providing them with arms? No. Are we providing? Are we saying we're going to intervene militarily to help bring down the regime? We're not saying that. And I think that Netanyahu was prudent in putting the kibosh on those ministers who are, you know, sort of flexing their muscles publicly vis-a-vis Iran. And why? It's not in Israel's interest. Right now, we have the Iranian regime struggling for its life against its own population, with the United States threatening to intervene. What would we have to gain from this, other than providing a pretext for the Iranians to strike us back at us? So, I think we're operating, I think, responsibly, prudently, and again, Israel has only to gain from this. I can only stress, as someone who has written history, lived an awful lot of history, that we are in a position right now that is probably the finest geostrategic position we have known in our history, at any time in Israel's existence. If you would have told me we'd ever be in a situation like this when I moved here, probably about a half century ago, I'd say you were nuts. I'd want to know what drugs you were on. I mean, not just the peace with Egypt and Jordan and the Abraham Accord countries, but now negotiations with the Lebanese, negotiations with the Syrians. If we play our domestic political cards right and we have a government that's able to meet it, even symbolically, some of Saudi Arabia's conditions, we could have peace with Saudi Arabia, peace with the Sunni Arab world. Our biggest challenge in the coming years, especially for you of your generation, will be how to deal with all this peace.
I think we'll have to set up some new ministries that will be in charge of... Like, I want to think it's a bit of a left turn, perhaps, but I do want to take advantage of the fact that you're on the podcast. One of the favorite claims or arguments or things to talk about, whether it's by Tucker or by Candace, by David Smith, their ilk, is the USS Liberty incident. And I was wondering if you could tell us what really happened in the USS Liberty.
That's always a separate two podcasts, okay? You want the one-foot version of this, huh? Again, in another book, the Six-Day War book, 6 Days of War, also available at famously reduced prices today, a whole section on the Liberty. And you won't find anything that has been published really since then that's going to add to what's in that book. And almost every document relating to the Liberty has been declassified, including even the recordings of the Israeli pilots involved in the attack, the recordings of the American spies who were flying both in our skies and operating under our waters, so much for allies not spying on allies. And I'll give you just the short of it. The Liberty was a spy ship. It was not operating under the auspices of the U.S. Navy, but under the National Security Agency. It came into our waters. It came into waters that were war waters, into a combat zone, on June 8th, 1967, without telling anybody. Didn't tell the U.S. Navy, didn't tell the embassy in Tel Aviv. Certainly didn't tell us. And it came into a time when there was active combat in the area. There were reports of an Egyptian ship operating there. There was reports of an Egyptian ship shelling Israeli paratroopers on the shores of El Arish in Egypt. And Israeli planes who flew over the ship did not at first identify a flag. They asked the Israeli Navy to come and take out the ship with torpedo boats. They did. The Israeli planes also attacked the boat. And the minute anybody saw an American flag, at first they saw actually a life raft floating that said USS Liberty on it, everybody stopped firing and offered to assist the Liberty. So what's occurred there then is every couple of years, and now it's happening again, the charges that Israel attacked the Liberty deliberately. We knew exactly what it was. What they try to figure out every single time is why we attacked it. So you should know the original version said that the Liberty had got onto Israeli communications regarding the possible attack on the Golan Heights, which occurred the next day, which is very funny because Liberty had no Hebrew speakers aboard it. It only had Arabic and Russian speakers aboard it because they thought they were spying on the Russians and the Egyptians. That's how late they were. That's how out of it the Liberty was. Then there was a book that came out that said that the reason the Liberty was destroyed was because the Liberty overheard conversations of Israeli officers massacring Egyptian prisoners of war, whatever that sounds like on a radio. Okay, no kidding. Or the Liberty was listening to communications relating to the Dimona nuclear reactor. They're always struggling to find out why we did it. But why we did it is why so many accidents like this happen in war, including in this war, where 20% of our casualties are friendly fire casualties, because war is confusion. Because in war, and you've been there, Asher, you shoot first and you ask questions later. And I will say this on a personal level. I have been in several wars, and I've probably seen more Israeli soldiers killed by Israeli fire than I have been by enemy fire. In broad daylight, by the way, because that's war.
When you were ambassador, I mentioned this to people a lot, that you experienced like campus riots when you came to campuses to speak.
Yeah, the Irvine 11,
like
that was
Yeah. Well, and oh, I mean, also Netanyahu at, I think it was Concordia University, like more than 20 years ago also. Like, so people, while the campus atmosphere was a lot worse in the last couple of years, maybe, than it had been historically, there's still nothing new under the sun. But in any case, I guess as somebody who, as you had called yourself, sort of Mr. U.S. Israel, how do you see things with the rising anti-Semitism and the hostile atmosphere in academia to really anything Jewish or Israeli, right? Like, it used to be if you were like a Peace Now person or breaking the silence, at least you'd be welcomed. But now it's like if you're Israeli or proudly Jewish even.
We're witnessing the culmination, or let's say the apogee of two historical processes, parallel processes. One is that 8 decades after the Holocaust, the memory of the Holocaust has faded. In the aftermath of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism was considered unsavory, and is no longer true. The old method we have for fighting anti-Semitism was to, you know, expose the anti-Semites, shame the anti-Semites, and educate the anti-Semites. But you can't do that anymore, because you don't have to expose the anti-Semites. They're out parading their anti-Semitism. You can't shame them. They're very proud of their anti-Semitism. And you can't re-educate them. So that old method just does not work anymore, because anti-Semitism is out there once again, and the world has reverted to form. What the world looks like today is a world that looked like, you know, to my great-grandparents, even to my grandparents, maybe your great-grandparents. So it's nothing new, as you say, nothing new under the sun. That's one historical process. The other process is what's happened in American universities. And that's a process that begins in the 1960s with the Youth Revolution, which tried to export its ideas beyond the university gates. It didn't succeed in the 60s, so these rebels went back into the campuses and they closed the gates behind them. And they spent the next 30, 40 years inculcating their ideas and instilling these ideas in their students, who then went out into the world and became, you know, the editors, the heads of industry, and of course, officials in Congress and in the White House. And I encountered those people directly during the Obama administration. I actually knew, I could almost tell what professors they had had at university, what books they had read. And this was an investment over time. We often refer to it among my colleagues as sort of the posthumous victory of the Soviet Union, of Soviets. So, and the campuses today, nothing is going to change. I don't care, you know, with all due respect to what President Trump has done to fight anti-Semitism on campuses, you know, whether you fight, get a president of universities to resign or get them chucked out, it's not going to change. It's not going to change as long as there is a tenure system in American universities. This, my dear friend Gil Troy has written about this extensively. He's absolutely right. Because if you're a professor of Middle Eastern studies who thinks of the state of Israel as something beneath the ninth circle of hell, and you come for you to retire, you're not going to choose somebody who's getting up in the morning and singing Hatikva. You're going to think to yourself, someone who thinks exactly like you do. So the whole position on Israel perpetuates itself. And it's not just about Israel. It's, you know, it's the Department of American Studies is going to be the Department of Anti-American Studies. Department of Jewish Studies is going to be the Department of Anti-Israel Studies. It's not going to change. Columbia University just hired a new head of the Jewish Studies Department who's a rabid anti-Zionist. This is after everything that happened on Columbia, after the deal with Trump, okay? And so for American Jewish students, they have to know if they want to go to these, you know, elite colleges, they have to know that, yes, maybe they'll get a decent education. That's another issue, whether they're actually getting a decent education. But they're going to have to fight. Now, here's the good news. There are about 4,000 campuses in the United States. The disturbances occurred on about 60 of them. So let's not, you know, say this is about all American campuses. And there's some very fine places like the University of Texas, University of Miami, University of Florida, where this did not happen.
I hear Vanderbilt has become very popular with
Tulane,
Jews.
Well, Tulane had some trouble, but still, you know, you can get a very fine education. And some cases for a fraction of the price than some of these places, okay?
Michael, you were ambassador at a time, not across the board, but of significant tension between the United States and Israel under President Obama, and you wrote a book about that. I'm looking ahead. On the one hand, Netanyahu's recent visit to Mar-a-Lago, we saw, I think, an unbelievable display of the degree to which the U.S. and Israel and the president and the prime minister have a warm, cooperative relationship. But President Trump also is pushing forward with his Board of Peace, and it's expected to be announced in the next couple of weeks. There is Hamas, in fact, announced, or there's a video where a senior Hamas official said that they instructed the agencies, the civilian agencies in Gaza, to prepare for handing over power to these civilian bodies. We've long argued here on the podcast and at the Miskav Institute that Hamas is indeed willing to turn over its civilian responsibilities. It doesn't want to be in charge of garbage collection or in terms of the electricity or plumbing in Gaza. At this point, it would rather turn that over to an international or Palestinian technocratic actors, as long as it could keep its military predominance and its first dibs on the economy, goods coming in, reconstruction materials for its military purposes. Do you think we're going to get to a friction point or a point of a clash between the United States and Israel in the coming weeks over, on the one hand, President Trump's desire to have this Board of Peace and this Palestinian Committee and an international stabilization force being deployed perhaps along the yellow line, and Israel, which is going to have to recognize the fact that Hamas is still fully armed, has shown no intent of disarming? And if you were advising Prime Minister Netanyahu, who you worked under, what advice would you give him towards navigating this potential conflict point?
We're absolutely right, Azra. There are a number of flashpoints here, not just the ones you mentioned. Let's begin with the price of the end of this war, the return of the hostages. You pay a price in blood, you pay a price in treasure. You pay a price, Israel pays a price in terms of our external relations, but we've also paid a price in terms of our sovereignty. For the first time in our history, we have a foreign military body on our soil in Kiryat Gat. I visited there several weeks ago. Soldiers from not just the United States, 200 American soldiers, but soldiers from Spain, soldiers from France, England, places that are not particularly friendly to the state of Israel, are sitting in our city in military uniforms. They are monitoring the IDF movements and restricting the IDF movements. That is unprecedented in our history. That was the price. We have different interpretations of what constitutes a violation of the ceasefire. So if an Israeli soldier is wounded or, God forbid, is killed, that's a major issue for the state of Israel. For the Americans, it could be a blip. You know, is that a reason to violate it, to break a ceasefire? A ceasefire that has the imprimatur of the present United States on it, as he has brought peace to the Middle East after 3,000 years of conflict. Keep in mind, peace. Remember that big sign on the stage that he got there, peace 2025? You know, we don't want to be in the position of belying that claim. And so there are many, many flashpoints here. And the next one you mentioned is the International Stabilization Force, which ideally is supposed to move into all of Gaza, not just the area under Israel's control. And that the IDF is supposed to withdraw gradually from the 53% of Gaza, which is under its control, and hand over the reins to this ISF. So here we have a problem. What happens if ISF comes into even the area under Israel's control and Israel withdraws militarily? Then Hamas is going to start firing over the heads of the ISF. And when we go to fire back at Hamas, we're going to end up hitting the ISF, right? As this, by the way, this nothing's new under the sun. This is what happened with UNIFIL. This has happened with even, you know, UNEF in Sinai in 1967. This is nothing new about this. Hamas is not, they're evil, but not stupid. And so we want, ideally, to resist the notion of the IDF pulling out and resist as much as possible, or at least slow down the deployment of the ISF. So you ask me, what would I recommend to the prime minister? And I would say to the prime minister, a little bit of rope-a-dope, if that means anything to you. You know, it's with Muhammad Ali used to keep his boxing gloves up and just take the hits and let the other guy wore himself out. Right now, there's not a tremendous number of countries that are lining up to contribute soldiers to the ISF because they know what's going to happen. They're going to end up either getting into between a firefight between Israel and Hamas or having themselves to suppress Hamas, which they don't want to do, especially if they're Muslim countries. And so there's not a lot of volunteers for this thing. And let's not make a crisis until we actually get to the point where we may have to say, you know, thank you for everything, but we're not there yet. It's quite cool. Right now, according to press reports, the IDF is preparing for a major operation in the Hamas-controlled section of Gaza coming up next March. So we may be in a very different place. The president can certainly make his peace board, make his peace, try to train for the ISF. I heard when I was down in Kiryat Gat, where the CMCC is located, this international military base, that they're planning to build a training base in Jordan and also a training base, a large training base along the Gaza border for the ISF. You know, be my guest. Be my guest. We shouldn't oppose it until such a time that Israel's fundamental security interests are at stake.
So we need to wrap up, but before we go, I want to ask you, you've been doing a lot of writing on your Substack and for the Free Press, but I want to know what you're working on next. Ooh. I was just remembering that a couple years ago, and I can't remember if this was before or after October 7th, I called you and you told me you had been working in the archives of the Kiryat or something like that on your next book. So are you still working on that? And if you could tell us what it is.
Well, I was really working on a major work about the War of Independence, because we don't have a major work about the American independence, but that's going to have to wait. A year ago, last June, June 24, I did perhaps one of the most reckless moves in my academic career. I signed an agreement with HarperCollins in New York to publish the first book about this war. Now, there are, and I'm not exaggerating, there are about 700 books about October 7th. A new one comes out every week. There is not a single book about the war. And here we are living through, I would quote a cab driver I had the other day who said, we're not living during historical times, we're living during biblical times. This war is more transformative than the 67 war. If it ends truly with peace with our neighbors and a transformed Middle East, there's nothing about it. And no one's writing about it. And no one understands exactly what's happened here over the last 2.5 years.
By the way, it's also been very transformative for Israeli society and for Israel's whole national security mindset and paradigm.
Many things. I mean, you could say that, you know, that the Haredi issue on October 6, 2023 was a left-wing issue. And now Haredi service in the military is a national issue that's actually being led by the right wing, by the Nit Kippah national religious people. There's a transformation for you. And so I have set out to write this book. Now, it has turned out the book is so voluminous that I have divided it into two volumes. And hopefully the first volume will cover between October 6th and with the introduction, October 7th to November 2024, when you have a major change of cast of characters, both in the United States and in Israel, and you have a very different war. But the research, this is all-encompassing for me, not just academically, but emotionally, because I'm living through it again. And I'll just say this, that the job of an historian, I always say the first job, is that of decision maker. You're given 100 facts, you've got to choose one. You're given 100 stories of heroism, of sacrifice, of suffering, you got to choose one. Which means you suffer over the 99 you didn't select. And I have to tell the whole story, which means I got to tell the Palestinian side too. And that's difficult, to try to be even-handed, to try to sort of view my own biases, my own prejudices as obstacles to be overcome rather than as, you know, as preconceived notions to be indulged. And that's difficult because I want to write a history. Now, I understand that this is not 20 years ago when I wrote the 67 war book. We're in a different world. So I'll just give you an example. Certainly, when I write about Hamas, I don't write about fighters. I don't write about militants, certainly. Militants are somebody who feels strongly about something. Unless you feel strongly about raping and burning and murdering, then Hamas is not a militant. And I call them terrorists. A person who belongs to an internationally recognized terrorist organization that carries out acts of terrorism is a terrorist, okay? Not a fighter, not a gunman, not anything else. So I refer to Hamas people, okay, as terrorists. That is going to, I think, you know, blackball this book among a lot of readers. But I have to be true to it. I have to ask myself, how can you call Hamas members who do what they did on October 7th anything other than terrorists? And had they done it to any other population in the world, certainly to the United, to Americans, there would have been no debate over whether they'd be called terrorists. No debate. The only reason they're called militants is because they killed Jews.
Michael, thank you so much for joining Mideast Horizons. Where can people find you? People who want to know you have your Substack. Where's the best place for people to follow you?
So two things. So my Substack is called Clarity, and it is certainly online. Please join. You can go onto my website. It's the Israel Advocacy Group. It was an organization I founded around my kitchen table on October 8th, 2023, which advocates around the world. Every time you see me on TV, that's through the Israel Advocacy Group, IAG. And it's involved in many different areas, including supporting people from the North. I was in the North last week and visiting communities that have not recovered from the war at all and still very much endangered, by the way, strategic danger to the state of Israel. IAG. So you can certainly see all of that there.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great honor. Good to see you both. Lahav Asher, Tadal Ba. Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you for joining us. Please make sure to like, subscribe, and share this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow the Miskav Institute at www.miskavins.org and across all social media platforms. You can send us your comments, your questions, your suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.